thought we should set aside some time today to get the perceptions of him and his, is it a branch or an office now down at the Science Center that's really looking at this. So appreciate you coming down. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. As always, I am most grateful for the chance to have a chance to address the council. It's been over a year, I think, since I've last filled you in on where things stand. I want to take this opportunity to let you know about some developments at the center and also at, on the national stage in terms of moving towards an ecosystem approach to fisheries management. I'm going to go through a couple of developments that we've been working on at the center in terms initially in terms of supporting the GARM process, but addressing some ecosystem terms of reference for the GARM. So we're trying to work in a way that's complementary and certainly not replacing the single species approaches that we have currently in place, but we're hoping to find the best mix of convergence between taking in ecosystem considerations into management and then taking advantage of the results that have come from the single species assessments, the ones that you've been dealing with routinely here in the council. So they are intended to be complementary. These are the issues that I want to cover today. First is to introduce this idea that John just mentioned of the ecosystem assessment program at the Northeast Center. I want to just give a brief overview of some of the main elements of an ecosystem-based management strategy and how it's evolving in the United States. I want to go back to some important work that was sponsored by the council in terms of looking at objectives for EBM on the Northeast Shelf through a series of meetings that were held up and down the coast under Chad Demarest's leadership in 2005. And I think some very important things related to ecosystem processes and objectives for management emerged from that initial attempt to look at how various stakeholder groups felt about moving towards an ecosystem approach. And then I'm going to move into the issues that we dealt with specifically for the GARM by trying to provide this ecosystem perspective that I mentioned. And then finally, I'm going to end with an issue that we're going to have to deal with as we move towards an ecosystem approach, and that's really confronting trade-offs that emerge either among different ocean use sectors or among the potentially against among different species that are interacting in the ecosystem. So this is something that we're not currently having to deal with under our management structures, but we will have to deal with in an ecosystem approach. So I'd like to try to give you some ideas of what how this might emerge and what are some of the issues that range not only in resource species but protected species, for example. So that's what I hope to accomplish today. First, let me tell you about this ecosystem assessment program. We've formed a new unit at the center to support your efforts in moving towards an ecosystem approach to management. We now have a group dedicated to development of ecosystem assessments, ecosystem fishery management plans in this region. And this is being done in a way that's a group that reports directly to the center directorate. It's outside the current division structure. Most of you know that we have four major divisions in the center that deal with different aspects of marine systems and marine ecology. The one, of course, that you're most familiar with is the division that deals specifically with the assessment activities, the single species assessment activities. But basically, what I'd like to point out, the main research objective we have for our ecosystem assessment program is really to focus on natural and human-related factors that are affecting production in marine ecosystems. And you're routinely dealing with the idea of production on a single species basis when you're thinking about the effects of individual species growth and mortality factors. I'm going to turn in this presentation towards the end of thinking about production at an ecosystem level, and we're going to start right at the base of the food web and trace that through. But we're interested in taking that as one perspective that does differ and complements the single species approaches. And then finally, we are quite interested in understanding the whole implications for the human communities that are dependent on these systems for ecosystem goods and services. So we're envisioning this from a research perspective of requiring sustained ecosystem observations, which we have undertaken at the center. Research that's designed to try to understand underlying ecological mechanisms. That's what's meant by that bit on process-oriented research, and then modeling to pull it all together. So those are the things I'd like to talk about. I'm sure most of you are aware of this, but at the highest levels in NOAA, there's a very strong commitment to moving towards an ecosystem approach to management. It's one of the central themes that are being developed. Now, some of the legislative and regulatory frameworks are not as far advanced as some of the thinking in terms of moving in the ecosystem approach, and that's one of the things we're going to have to deal with. But I want you to know that this is something that's recognized as critically important and at the agency level, at the NOAA level, and, of course, also at the National Marine Fisheries Service level. There have been a number of statements about what's involved in terms of moving towards an ecosystem approach to management. This one happens to come from an advisory panel that was convened by NIMS, a scientist outside the National Marine Fisheries Service, but to advise on moving towards this ecosystem approach. And basically, there are a number of statements of this type, and they all have a number of common elements. One is that we need to understand the nature of the relationships among the species in the system, how they're interacting. We need to understand how natural climate and weather factors are affecting their abundance, their distribution, and so on. And then we basically commonly see in these kinds of statements a clear recognition that humans are an integral part of the ecosystem. And that means not only are we as humans affecting the ecosystem, but we're being affected by changes coming from natural sources and other factors. And, of course, these are the kinds of things that fishers have to deal with routinely in their livelihood. In terms of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, one of the striking developments in the reauthorization was a requirement for the National Marine Fisheries Service to make an inventory overall on a nationwide basis of where things stand in terms of our readiness to provide ecosystem-oriented research in regional fisheries management. We recently, earlier in the year, had a meeting convened among different fishery resource centers throughout the nation to evaluate and respond to Congress on this point, and we've submitted a report on that point. But more importantly, for our work here, under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, it allows for the establishment of regional pilot programs that are aimed to develop approaches to an ecosystem approach to management. And the Northeast region is one of the areas that have been selected for this initial priority listing of the development of what I'm going to refer to as integrated ecosystem assessments. That's a term that you're going to hear quite frequently in the future. It's intended to be a complement and an analog of the single species assessment, but dealing with ecosystem-related issues. So we've been selected on the Northeast Shelf as one of the initial three pilot areas. The other two are on the West Coast, one in the California current region off of California, Oregon, and Washington, and then the third off the coast of Alaska. So we've been selected to begin this process, and one of the main objectives we have in the development of this ecosystem assessment program is to meet this responsibility that we've been given. Here are some elements of what an integrated ecosystem assessment will contain and how it will be used as a tool in ecosystem-based management. One, we want to look at multiple indicators of the environment and ecosystem, including human-related factors. It's going to be a broad-based look at how things are changing in the system at a number of different levels. A common theme in all the definitions of this ecosystem approach is that it's geographically specified. And in effect, one of the major things that will change as we move towards an ecosystem approach to management is that we'll be developing management plans for ecoregions overall. And embedded in that will be consideration of course, of the individual species that are resource species, those that are protected resources, and so on. But basically, the way this will look is that we'll have management plans for ecoregions. And I'm going to show you our first cut at what some ecoregions look like on the Northeast Continental Shelf. Then we're going to have to establish target levels and threshold for ecosystem components, just as we have to do the same for individual species as we're under the current management regime. And then we're going to evaluate the impacts of different management options and the risks of not attaining the target ecosystem states. Basically, in terms of this IEA process, one of the important things that's sitting right at the very heart of it is the idea of having an ecosystem model. It's an operating model. But you'll see that there are important elements for monitoring and observation that we all have to continue in terms of the work, not only in terms of work that's relevant to individual species assessments, but also more ecosystem-oriented things, including things like diet compositions, who eats who, and so forth, and other elements of the overall ecosystem structure. We're looking at integrated ecosystem assessments, taking this information from the monitoring and observation programs, looking at different decision strategies and decision rules, and implement the process, and then feed this into the ecosystem model to evaluate the efficacy of the steps that we've been taking. And that ecosystem model includes not only the principal elements of the ecosystem itself, but also the management process as it plays out under the different strategies that we'll adopt. One of the things that we'll be doing in terms of this mix of natural, human-related, and ecosystem factors that I mentioned is to have a set of indicators that are separated into a number of different categories, including some that are designated as drivers. These include, for example, in our work, factors that relate to climate and how that's affecting the system. It also relates to a number of different human factors, including the growth of the human population in the coastal zone, seafood demand, and that sort of thing. These drivers, in turn, result in pressures on the system. So an example of a driver from a climate-related factor would be, for example, an increase in temperature in the system. That, in turn, could result in a change of what I'm going to refer to as a state variable. That might be the amount of habitat, thermal habitat in an area. That is, what's the area encompassed by different temperature regimes on the Northeast Continental Shelf. That's going to have impacts, both positive and negative, on certain species in the system. So, for example, a species that's at the southern extent of its range, if we have a decrease in the amount of cold water habitat in the region, that could have an adverse impact. Conversely, in an area for a more subtropical species, as we have in many areas in the mid-Atlantic region, for example, that might increase the area on the continental shelf, our continental shelf, that could be inhabited by that. And in fact, we're seeing examples of that type right now with Atlantic croaker that's both increasing in abundance and extending its range northward on the Northeast continental shelf. But once having identified a particular type of impact in the system, we're also then interested in what is the appropriate management response. And of course, this is where the role of the council comes in most strongly. And then having completed the process of implementing a management response, then we repeat the cycle by evaluating the current state and the drivers, pressures, states, and impact effects overall in the system. So we're classifying different types of indicators that we have of what's going on in the ecosystem according to these categories. And we're currently now in the ecosystem assessment program involved in the development of something we're calling an ecosystem status report that takes this basic framework and tries to trace through all the different forcing factors that we're facing in the system and how it plays out in terms of ecosystem responses overall in terms of these changes. That's just the same thing with a little bit to highlight the driver pressure state and impact and response elements. Again, there have been a number of statements of the principles of using an ecosystem-based management framework to manage marine resources. Again, you see at the top the development of spatial boundaries, an issue that we talked about before, development, a clear statement of the objectives from an ecosystem-based management, and that's an issue I want to touch on going back to the coastwide meetings that we had in 2005. Again, humans are identified in the third bullet as a critical part of the ecosystem, and we want to make sure that it's portrayed in that way. And then finally, the last three deal with different ways of framing management advice and coping with things such as uncertainty overall in both our understanding of the ecosystem and its natural variability. And then a couple of tools such as zoning. You're already familiar with the application of some of these principles of ocean zoning for coordinating multiple management sectors. And then finally, making sure we have the right linkage between the governance structures that are in place and the ecosystem elements themselves. So in terms of, let me first give you a brief overview of what we've defined in terms of what I'll refer to as ecoregions on the shelf. We took a number of different physiographic, oceanographic, and biological data sets from up and down the coast from Cape Hatteras to Nova Scotia, and we've put these in a statistical analysis to help us try to understand where common areas emerge in terms of having properties that are relatively consistent and at least the potential, holding the potential to become management unit areas, depending on considerations of how it matches with different activities within the marine ecosystem. This is a picture of what we get from doing that sort of analysis. There are a number of different areas, too, in the Gulf of Maine, eastern and western. In particular, the eastern one is principally in the Scotian Shelf region. George's Bank emerges as a separate entity for management purposes, as does the Mid-Atlantic Bight. And an important one that emerges fairly consistently in these analyses is right at the edge of the shelf break, where we have very unique ecological and oceanographic conditions. So those are the major regions that emerge in this first cut analysis that we've made in terms of potential management units that we would think about devising ecosystem management plans for. I'll turn next to some of the, I'm extracting some of the results from the stakeholder consultation meetings that were held up and down the coast, and I've really extracted the ones that deal with some critical issues in ecosystem-based management and reflect the views of those who attended these meetings in terms of some of the key issues that relate to ecosystem management and processes. This first one asked the respondents if they felt that fisheries management would be improved if fishing areas were defined by ecological characteristics. And here, a clear majority of the respondents indicated that they felt it would. So the kind of analysis that I just showed you in terms of trying to define ecoregions is trying to meet this recognized need by the respondents overall. So trying to make sure that we encompass factors in terms of defining the management areas that are based on ecological characteristics rather than, for example, political boundaries and that sort of thing. This question asks how current fisheries management, how effective is current fisheries management practices for the long-term health of the marine ecosystem? And here there was a bit of a split, but 50% of the respondents felt that it currently was ineffective. 30% felt that it was effective. 16 highly ineffective, and then highly effective 4%. So I think it's fair to say that there is a recognition that among the majority of the respondents that, in fact, in terms of looking at long-term health of the marine ecosystem, that there are changes that would be necessary in order to more fully address that objective. This question asks whether large-scale year-round closures were beneficial to fishermen. Here, the majority said no in terms of what was perceived as the fisheries benefit. But if you turn this question and ask how many felt it was these closure areas were critical for habitat protection, here a large proportion did feel that it was effective for habitat protection. And also, so here in that case, the utilization of closed areas really for different purposes, for different fisheries management purposes, it emerges that, in fact, we'd need to look at different criteria for what we really wanted to achieve. And so this gets to the point of having to have a clear statement of what we're hoping to do in an ecosystem perspective for fisheries management. Finally, an issue, or the next issue, is that was asked whether it's good to restrict fishing if productivity in the system decreases, and I will be talking about productivity pretty extensively in just a moment. And here, the majority of the respondents said that, in fact, we should switch our management strategies accordingly to changes in productivity patterns in the system. And, of course, you've been most recently having to deal with the issue of changes in productivity at individual stock levels in terms of their more recent groundfish assessment review meeting results. This one asks whether current fishery management practices negatively impact the marine ecosystem, and here nearly 60% felt that they did. So it wasn't adequately taking into account the effects of different fishery management practices on the marine ecosystem. And then finally, one that's quite important, extremely important among the respondents is, are trade-offs among fisheries adequately addressed in management? So this is the one that really cuts to the issue of interactions among the species that we're working with and whether we're really effectively dealing with those. And here, nearly 80% felt that we were not currently dealing adequately with trade-offs that emerge in the management context. A very large majority felt that, in fact, we need not only to consider the effects of fishing activities on the impacts of the marine ecosystem, but other impacts as well, including pollution, shoreline development, and a large number of other, set of other factors. So the main point that emerges, I think, from the consideration of the respondents here is that, one, I think it is fair to say that there's a good deal of interest in exploring the implications of looking at our fishery management practices from an ecosystem perspective. There have been some problems that have been identified in terms of our current practices and some advice, I think, in terms of how we might proceed in in future activities that are more explicitly directed towards looking at ecosystem-based management practices. Biodiversity is considered to contribute very strongly to a healthy fishery. So this one would also indicate that we'd want to have biodiversity considerations as an important consideration in the development of our objectives for fishery management. The strategy that we've been following to try to move towards an ecosystem approach in the Northeast Shelf region is conditioned, as I said, basically on understanding the production potential and how it's affected by environmental states. Particularly, we're interested in how climate-related changes might be affecting production on the shelf overall. So I'm going to show you some results that relate to that factor. Then we need to decide on sustainable exploitation rates that maintain ecosystem structure and function. Finally, specify a total level of removals from the system and the development of an allocation strategy for individual species. So I'll be telling you about some results that point to what we feel are the overall production levels for all the species in the system that we're considering. But, of course, we're always going to have to be interested in individual species and how they're affected by fishing. So we also need to have an allocation strategy in place that takes that into account. In terms of looking at the fishery production potential on the Northeast Shelf, in fact, it turns out that there is a pretty long history of trying to estimate what we could expect to be able to extract from the Northeast Shelf system on a sustainable basis. There have been some pretty important changes in orientation and in terms of what we now feel are safe levels of removal, but these that I'm listing here reflect an earlier idea that suggests that perhaps we could take as much as 50% of the production out on a sustainable basis. As I'm sure you're all aware now, that the general thinking is that that's not sufficiently conservative from an ecosystem point of view. But with that caveat, one of the initial estimates that was made for the production potential on the shelf put it at about 1.8 to 2.2 million tons, some work by Bob Edwards, who was a former center director at the Northeast Center. Dick Hennemuth, at that time, actually deputy center director, provided an estimate of 1.3 million tons based on another analysis. From an FAO-related activity, there was an estimate of nearly 1.6 million tons for the shelf. And then finally, one based on a number of different modeling approaches, by David Awe that put the range between 1.5 and 3.8 million tons. And I should say that the 3.8 million tons was an estimate actually that suggested that we could, in fact, take as much as 70% of the production out of the system. And I think that that sort of view is actually no longer supported by the evidence that we have. But that's an idea of the range that we've been dealing with. There are also some aggregate and aggregate production model results that were used to develop an estimate for the total system MSY on the shelf. This is some work that was done in the early 1970s, and it's a kind of model that you're used to seeing in a single species context, except now it's actually dealing with the aggregate production, so it's sum total of all the fish species that were being harvested. When they did that analysis, the estimate that emerged was just under a million metric tons for the shelf. And when they compared that result against the sum of individual single species assessment levels in the designated MSY, it was lower by about 30% than that taking the individual species. And one of the principal ideas that was put forward at the time was that the fact that the total system MSY level was lower really related to the fact that there are important interactions among the individual species in the system, and so that they all can't be simultaneously at their MSY levels and ignoring the fact that there are these kinds of biological interactions among them. In terms of trying to put this in context, in terms of what the actual landings have been over time, this is a designation for the entire Northeast Shelf region. What you're seeing is a couple of important things, including we're starting in 1960, and this perturbation here is when the distant water fleets arrived off our coast and started to heavily exploit our resources. So that very rapid fishing up effect you see is the result of the distant water fleet operation, so the factory trawlers. Unfortunately, it's very clear that that level of harvesting was not sustainable, and we had a sequence of declines in a number of key resource species, and the distant water fleets moved sequentially between them and sequentially depleted a range of our important groundfish species. But in the late 1970s, of course, the 200-mile limit came in place, and we became under increasingly domestic control in the fisheries, and things leveled off. Although one thing that you see is that there have been some pretty important changes in the relative species compositions that we're dealing with. That green at the top really involves all the invertebrate species, including scallops, surf clam, ocean quahogs, and of course the crustacean species that are important, but really dominated by the bivalves. And you can see that that's quite important overall in the picture that we currently have, where we've had a diminishing, for example, diminishing importance of the groundfish species, for example, in the red at the bottom. And we've had some pretty important fluctuations in the pelagic fish component of the system. That's in the light blue there. But anyways, we've had some pretty important changes overall in the composition of the landings over this time period. So I'm going to tell you about some methods to try to find out, using contemporary ideas, how we could actually trace through and try to understand what the production potential of the shelf is. And I'm going to use this idea of a trophic pyramid. And we're going to step up through this trophic pyramid using some classifications that relate to, one, the microscopic plants that are at the base of the food web. And those are going to be referred to as trophic level one. These, in turn, are fed on by small crustaceans, principally zooplankton, at trophic level two. The zooplankton, in turn, are fed on by forage fish, trophic level three, fish-eating fish that often prey on these forage base, trophic level four, and apex predators at trophic level five. And, of course, humans are exploiting at a range of different levels in the ecosystem overall. Now, the story is a little bit more complicated because, in fact, many species feed at more than one trophic level, so we have fractional levels for trophic designations for the species. But this will give you a basic idea of what we want to do is trace through the flow of energy starting at the base of the food web with these phytoplankton and moving upward in this direction. And what we need to know is the transfer efficiencies of energy from one step to the next. And in the modeling, although I won't go into detail here, we've incorporated a number of estimates of how the transfer efficiency changes as you go from step to step. But basically, the main result is that it's roughly 20% trophic efficiency from going from this first step to the next step, and then roughly between 10 and 15% the rest of the way up. And that's important because, of course, it really controls how much energy gets up to these upper levels. And you can see the higher up in the food chain you go, the less energy there is to support these populations. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why they're lower abundance than at the lower trophic levels. So this is a view of some of those plants that are at the very base of the food web that I want to tell you about. So they're microscopic, and so it's very different than the situation on land, where these have are tiny plants and they have very short life cycles, and so very different than the situation we have in the primary producers on land that are shrubs, grasses, trees, and so forth. Now, it might seem a long stretch to go through looking at how much we have at the base of the food web and what it actually means in terms of what we could expect to catch. But in fact, there have been a number of analyses, like the one that I'm showing here, where there have been estimates made in different ecosystems of the primary production. So that's basically the amount of this plant growth at the base of the food web, and how much catch you can get out of that, or how much catch you did get out of it. And they almost invariably show a very clear relationship that shows the higher the level of the primary production, the higher the level of catches that you can expect. And this cluster of points in this region here is really reflecting some results both from the North Atlantic and North Pacific ecosystems. But up at the top, this really high level of primary production and catch are from upwelling systems, such as the one off of Peru, where the Peruvian anchoveta is an important catch. In fact, the single largest volume catch that we have on a global basis. But this gives you an idea that it is, in fact, quite sensible to look at trying to trace things through from the base of the food web all the way up to what we could expect to catch. So now I want to try to show you how things change in terms of the production cycle on our shelf. And basically, I'm going to show you an animation of some satellite data that's coming from the CWIF sensor. And basically what you're looking at here, starting in August and going through mid-October, are blooms of these phytoplankton. The measure that we're getting from the satellites is the chlorophyll, the stuff that makes plants green, basically, that can be picked up by the sensors. And you're seeing a couple things, including the emergence of these hot spots where we have blooms of the phytoplankton, and you've also seen some indications that we have of warm core rings, that are those circular areas off the edge of the shelf, pulling some of this production off the shelf. So I'll just run through that one more time so you can see. So the circular areas off the shelf are these warm core rings that are actually, in some cases, entraining phytoplankton right off the shelf. The main point is that you'll see it's a very dynamic sort of a system. You see a bloom developing there on Georgia's Bank, for example, and along the coast of Maine. The phytoplankton production is very high along the coast, where there's a large amount of nutrients coming in from the land, basically. So you've just seen basically a result that is pretty common in terms of the overall patterns that we see. I'm going to show you a somewhat less common kind of result of a bloom developing off of New Jersey in the summertime. Normally the blooms occur in the springtime and in the fall. I guess the projector doesn't like that picture. Let me see if I can get it to go. So you can see that large bloom developing just north of Delaware Bay and in the offings of the Hudson Channel. You'll also see a warm core ring that's developing off the coast there. The reason that the warm core rings are blue is actually there's low nutrients in, overall in the Gulf Stream and low phytoplankton productivity on the Gulf Stream as a whole. But the main point is that through satellite imagery, we're able to get a handle on this primary production, this amount of plant growth at the base of the food web. And you'll see in a moment that we see a fair bit of regional and interannual variability when we look at summaries of the results. So that upper left panel shows the average conditions in terms of primary production for the shelf as a whole. It's showing a hot spot on Georges Bank. It's relatively low productivity on average in the Gulf of Maine in the deep water basin areas and quite high right in the immediate coastal areas. The panels that you see to the right, though, are ones different for different individual years in this analysis. And basically what you're seeing is that by the changes in the color patterns, you can see that there's a fair bit of difference that emerges from year to year in, for example, the importance of primary productivity in the Gulf of Maine, here a low productivity year, and here a high productivity year, and so on. So there are some very important year-to-year changes and also regional changes that we are taking into account in our analyses. But it's an important point to understand that this reinforces the idea of looking at regional evaluations of the productivity characteristics. We can also take a look at how much of the primary production is basically used up in going into supporting the catch. And this is a result that comes from the primary production analyses that I looked at, that I showed you a moment ago, and looking at the things such as the mean trophic level in the catch. And I'm going to show you more about that in a moment. But the main point that I want to make here is that at the during the period of the operation, the distant water fleets, as much as 50% of the primary production was being used to support the fisheries. And generally speaking, that's considered to be an unsustainable level. And that seems to have been supported by the fact that we had some very severe declines in the resources overall. More recently, we've got a much more reasonable level of about 12 to 15% of the primary production that's going into supporting the fisheries on our shelf. So we have gotten things under a more manageable control. In part, this relates to the fact that we're fishing lower on the food web, though, so we're taking less out by focusing on lower parts of the trophic level of the food web, rather. And this is a picture of how things have changed in terms of the average trophic level. So the trophic level is as I described it earlier in the talk and how it's changing over time. And it's gone down, and this is really reflecting the importance of, for example, those bivalve species, the scallops, surf clams, and ocean quahogs, that feed really basically on phytoplankton. So they're really quite low in the food chain, feeding quite low in the food chain, whereas back here we're basically taking out a large number of fish-eating fish, for example, overall. So we have seen this change in terms of the characteristics of the fishery, and it has some important implications for basically how we're affecting the ecosystem. To get to the point of looking at the fishery production potential, going through the sequence of calculations that I alluded to earlier, basically we've got a couple things that we've looked at, including where in the food web we're concentrating our activities, and so that's this bit that deals with the mean trophic level that you see along the x-axis there, and it's going from basically a region where we're currently operating now in this end of the spectrum up to where we were operating when the distant water fleets were in operation off our coast. And we're also looking at here at what fraction you could remove. Now, our estimates for the sustainable exploitation rates put this more in this end of the range, about 15%. If that's the case and we're fishing where we currently are, the estimate is that we can take just under 1 million metric tons total from the shelf. If we try to maintain that same exploitation rate but have a higher mean trophic level in the catch, so having more fish-eating species, for example, then that estimate comes down to more like 500,000 metric tons on the shelf. And Jen, just to try to put that in perspective, again, looking at this figure, you can see that currently, right now, we're just under 1 million metric tons of landings. And let me point out that this invertebrate landings estimate is for the live weight of the catch, not the landed weight of the catch. So that's quite important. From energy considerations, we want the live weight rather than the landed weight. But you're perhaps much more familiar with looking at the landed weight for the invertebrates. So it's generally consistent with what we're saying in terms of what could be extracted from this system at the current trophic level that we're operating, mean trophic level that we're operating under in this system. If we want to raise, for example, the importance of the fish-eating species, cod, silver hake, and a number of the others that are piscivores, then our expectation is that the total sustainable catch would be lower overall on the shelf. We also tried to compare where we are in our shelf ecosystem with a number of others throughout the Atlantic and Pacific. And basically, what you're looking at here are estimates of the biomass density in tons per kilometer squared for a number of different systems, the Gulf of Alaska, Bering Sea, and then a number of Eastern Atlantic groups, and then here, Canadian and U.S. fisheries. And the main point is that here, although there's some pretty wide variation, including the highest biomass overall in the Bering Sea, our system under its current estimated total biomass is very close to the average of all these others here at about essentially 15 tons per kilometer squared. If we were to meet our targets under the current management strategies that we're pursuing, that would actually would increase a bit, but still very close to the average. So we're basically, this will give you an idea of how we fit in relative to many of these other systems. I want to turn last in terms of the idea of the analyses that we've done in support of the GARM to tell you about some work that we did that essentially revisited that aggregate production model of the type that I showed you earlier, except doing it just for the GARM species. And basically what you're seeing here is the time series fit of the model. The model is actually fitting both survey data. Again, this is summed over, in this case, over all the GARM species in the light blue, and using catch data for those GARM species. And then we're fitting a model to it. And here you're seeing the red is the predicted overall biomass level trajectory, and it's just comparing against what the survey said was going on in the system. So you can see that we had declined through the late 1980s, through the mid-1990s, and then have begun a recovery process, and that's picked up in this aggregate production model. Just as I showed you before, a comparison between what the aggregate production model looked like and the sum of the individual species MSY levels, we went through the same exercise for the GARM species. And basically, you may know that, in fact, in the latest GARM results that were presented to the Council, there were revisions that reflected newer data based on some of our initial estimates in the GARM process. And basically, we had here, you're looking at those initial estimates of the GARM, maximum sustainable yield estimates of just under 200,000 metric tons. Our estimate for using, with that original data, using the aggregate value was actually about 35% lower here. That's indicated in this red bar here. So we were showing, just as in that initial example, quite a bit lower estimates. In fact, just about the same level of difference that initial analysis from the 1970s that I showed you about showed, indicating again this idea of having a difference between what you could expect when you took into account implicitly species interactions and what happens when you treated them individually. But one of the important developments, of course, with new data that went into the GARM estimates, the final GARM estimates that you saw, reflected changes in productivity overall. And so there was a decline in the estimate of the sum of the estimate of the sum of the MSYs from the individual GARM species. And in fact, when we redid our analysis with the new data, in fact, ours crept up a little bit. So basically what's happened is the two results now have converged to within less than 10% in terms of the overall projections of what you get from the initial individual species analyses and the ones that we're doing to try to reflect multi-species interactions. So basically, we're coming to the same general conclusion as more data became available, and some of the results that you saw in the revised GARM estimates of MSY really bring things more in line with what we're estimating from an ecosystem perspective. I want to close with a couple of issues that try to highlight some of this, an issue that we are definitely going to have to deal with in terms of moving towards an ecosystem approach, and this idea of trade-offs. And I'm going to use a subset of the species that we're dealing with here on the Northeast Shelf that have emerged as management concerns. Of course, one, the critical issue of what's going on with the cod stocks and why, until recently, at least in the Gulf of Maine, we haven't seen much evidence of recovery. You've also been heard a lot about the effect of the decline in the bluefin tuna condition, how that might be related to their prey resource availability. There's the issue of the herring fishery development on the human side in this story. And then finally, moving to protected resource species, the right whale recovery patterns. And what I want to show is some potential examples of how these things actually should be treated together as part of a whole story and really not dealt with individually. And in particular, some of the things that emerge is, when we look at the basic ecology of the system is that, for example, herring preying on zooplankton can have a direct effect on cod recruitment by competing with cod. And in some cases, actually, in a number of places of the world, it's been demonstrated that herring, for example, can actually prey on the larvae of cod and other species. And it could have an indirect effect on the right whales. And I'll also, as we go on, touch a bit on the prey availability issue for the bluefin tuna as well. So I want to try to weave these together and just to try to illustrate some of the kinds of things that we come into play when we think about this from a system-wide perspective rather than as a taking each piece separately. So this is the kind of basic diagram that we're looking at. We've got cod populations and their status right now here in the upper right. They're preying on herring populations. Herring are potentially preying on or competing with larval cod, as you see down in the bottom right. Both larval cod and herring prey on these zooplankton species here, this Calanus part of the story. And, of course, there's a feedback between what goes on with the larval cod and the juvenile and adult cod. And right whales are also preying on this species, Calanus, which is really the most common and important of the zooplankton species we have in our system. And, of course, there are interactions on the human side of the story with where we're fishing both cod and herring, of course. So the common story that you've seen now is the increase that we're estimating for herring biomass overall on the shelf as a whole. This comes from some of Bill Overholtz's work. So after a decline where reflecting the effects of the distant water fleets, there was throughout the 80s and 90s an increase, and then finally a leveling off in the earlier part of this century. This decade, for the abundance levels of herring. As they've increased, though, in fact, the average weight at each age from ages 4 and older has actually declined pretty sharply for herring over time. So if we think about the connection with bluefin tuna, for example, we would say that it's not so much necessarily that there are fewer prey resources, at least according to our estimates of herring abundance, but the quality of that prey might have, for energetic purposes for the tuna, may have actually declined quite a bit as the mean size or the average size, the weighted age for the herring has declined overall. This also reflects the fact that, in fact, the herring are impacting their own prey, these copepods and other species that I mentioned earlier, in fact, because they're obviously not getting enough prey to maintain their body weight. So they are having an impact on these copepod prey resources. Of course, these are the trends. These estimates don't reflect the most recent values for cod for the GARM, but show the general patterns that we've seen both in the Gulf of Maine and on Georgia's Bank over time and that decline. When you look at cod and herring populations throughout the North Atlantic, it's very common to see an inverse relationship between the cod and herring populations, and again, reflecting the potential of the interactions that I mentioned earlier on among those two species. The potential impact on right whales can come about because, in fact, essentially we've got the right whales prey on the older stages, the adult stages of Calanus, the Calanus species that I showed you earlier. This shows some of the sighting data for right whales in our area, and with, of course, a pretty important concentration in the Great South Channel area. But basically what we've found in some analyses is that the survival ratio of Calanus is inversely related to herring and mackerel abundance. So as herring and mackerel both increased, basically the number of the ratio of young to adult Calanus declined pretty sharply. So there's less available prey for right whales in this case. And then you'll see in a moment that, in fact, there's pretty clear evidence that the calving success of right whales is related to this adult Calanus population. I'll show you that in just a minute. But these are the trends in terms of the early stages, the juvenile stages of Calanus here, and basically they're getting higher and higher over time, whereas for the adult stages, proportionally they're going down and declining. And this is a picture of what one of those copepod species looks like. But the important thing here is that the number of right whale calves is pretty strongly related to what we're estimating for the adult Calanus populations in the area, particularly in the Great South Channel area. So you can see that there is potentially a quite strong relationship between what might be going on in the Calanus populations and how they're impacted by the predation by herring, for example, and other pelagic fishes, and what that might mean for calving success for right whales. So we're in the at the moment, we're looking at different models to try to pull these pieces together, and I do expect to be able to report back to the council on some of these results. But the main thing that I'd like to leave you with for this sort of the part of the story is that we really do need to be thinking about these things together. And when we move forward in terms of looking at management plans for ecoregions, in fact, that's what we're going to be trying to do. In fact, not take things in isolation, but look at the big picture overall. So in terms of where we're going with the ecosystem assessment program, basically to follow up on some of the last points that I just made with you, one, we're looking at ways of looking at, we're looking at different strategies to devise a catch allocation strategy to either maximize the yield of the revenues set to subject to a set of conservation constraints. Now, this bit of setting an allocation strategy really is going to depend very heavily on the guidance of the council and the choices that the council would make in terms of what we really want to achieve in terms of yield or revenues from the system. But the idea that we're working on is that we would have this developed in such a way that we would develop a system-wide estimate of what the potential yield is, as I showed you earlier. And then we would take advantage of the information that we have from the individual species assessments to make sure that none of them would drop below critical levels. So we want to try to maximize, in some sense, the production that goes to the fishery from these system from the system, but also making sure that we have the appropriate safeguards in place for the individual species and also safeguards for the habitat, biodiversity issues that are important in terms of the kinds of work that David and Chad just told you about from the work of the Habitat Committee. And then finally, we do need to develop new methods for coping with the fact that we would have multiple objectives, some of which deal with our resource species, some of which deal with protected resources. And we need to find a way to weigh these different objectives that we might have in terms of making our decisions. And so there actually are some statistical methods that are well-developed for dealing with that, and we're working in terms of trying to move forward with that sort of an approach. And finally, I'd just like to thank my colleagues on the Ecosystem Assessment Program team that contributed to the work in this presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Mike. Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mike. I suspect the Magnuson Act won't be changed to allow for, say, the typical, you know, fish down dogfish to fish up cod or fish down some other species to rebuild another one. I suspect that won't be changed until you develop those models. So how much time, effort, and funding is dedicated to that ecosystem modeling that might allow those trade-offs?
Well, it's a major effort underway right now in terms of a principal focus of what we're doing, Paul, in our group. I would say that currently under Magnuson, we do have a certain amount of latitude in terms of trying to address some of these issues, except for when we're dealing with species that are under rebuilding plans. And, of course, I mean, that is a significant issue for us now, but once we get past that point, we will have, even under the existing statute, some latitude. So these are things I think that we could begin to develop and deal with in a concrete way as some of these issues are finalized, and hopefully, too, in future reauthorizations of Magnuson, that we'd be able to grapple with some of these issues that relate to trade-offs more fully.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You pointed out something. I just wanted to highlight it. The single species combined MSYs went in GARM 3 from 196,000 metric tons to, I think it was 143,000 metric tons or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, your work using productivity models went from 114,000 metric tons to 136,000 metric tons. Mm-hmm. So the difference between them went from about 82,000 to about 7,000, which actually is less than 6%. Mm-hmm. And to me, that provides excellent verification of both models, because they're independently arrived at, and within 6% of the same combined MSYs for all GARM-3, and I find that to be remarkable. I wanted to let you know that. And the other thing is, do you foresee managing, instead of managing by MSY, at some point to be managing by a ratio among all of the different species that we would be aiming toward? Is that basically where you're going here?
Well, the kind of strategy I outlined at the end, Dave, would suggest that we might want to think about an MSY for the system as a whole and then find out how we want to actually try to harvest the components of it such that it would never exceed, the sum would never exceed that total. But we could build in different kinds of objectives that, for example, do look at ratios. For example, you know, currently right now we have an example of the kind of ratio that David's talking about is, say, the ratio of demersal to pelagic fishes, which has really changed very radically over the last 30 years to one that's now dominated by pelagic fishes on our shelf. And so you could think about a strategy in which you had as an objective a range of that ratio that you try to maintain, and it might allow more or less harvesting of different parts of the system in order to achieve that result.
Dave Gethel.
Thank you, Mike. I mean, this to me, as you know, this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. It's what first attracted me to biology 40 years ago. One of the statements you had on your list there was a risk of not attaining target ecosystem states. Mm-hmm. Is that in Magnuson, or was that a result of the workshops and things that you've done in the last couple of years?
Yeah, that one is a result of the workshop activities overall. And as we've tried to develop this concept within the agency of integrated ecosystem assessment, so it emerged from that work, David. We've recently had, as I mentioned, a number of workshops, and we've That work is continuing on now to go from the conceptual phase where a number of us have developed this strategy for an integrated ecosystem assessments to applications in different regions. In fact, next month we're going to be holding a meeting in the Gulf of Mexico to move forward there, and we'll have in terms of the implementation of this strategy, and we'll also be having similar meetings throughout the coastal regions of the United States to move in that way.
Okay, and that's very interesting to me. The point I wanted to make out of this is that an ecosystem at some point when it's in balance is a steady state with things moving up and down within that ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And when something's radically out of balance, let's say, use right whales, use seals, use whatever you want, when that trophic pyramid is radically out of balance, one chunk of it's mm-hmm. shrunk radically, then things need protection at that point. Yep. But once it goes the other way, once you start protecting something to the exclusion of everything else, in other words, you have more of it than the pyramid can support, mm-hmm. you're putting the system back, it's out of balance again.
Yep.
And that's just as dangerous as having it out of balance from too little. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very, very important concept that people are going to have to understand, because mm-hmm. we are currently doing that right now, where we have a number of species that, for whatever reason, maybe they're cute and cuddly and have two eyes that face forward, so we think they're kind of like humans. We're putting them on a pedestal and saying you just can't touch these, and we're putting that pyramid out of balance. The other statement I heard you make, and I know this has been condensed because of our time constraints, was the one that I've been waiting to hear at this microphone for my entire adult life, and that is that everything can't be at maximum sustainable yield at the same time. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a fundamental principle that was, has been kind of lost in the last 30 years as we try to put everything at maximum sustainable yield at the same time. So it would be my hope that you could fly to Washington sometime and brief every Senate staffer that has been involved in writing Magnuson, the Magnuson reauthorization, on this presentation, because I think it's vitally important to the future of management. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, David.
Rip.
Thank you. It seems like that this is focusing on all of the biological aspects of it. Is there mm-hmm. some part of this that is looking at how you meld together all of the existing regulatory regimes that span mm-hmm. the spectrum of the ecosystems as well?
That's a very important point. Yeah, I mentioned briefly, for example, in the context of the driver pressure state part of the story, that the response element in that is where the regulatory actions come into play, and we consider how effective they've been in terms of trying to meet our objectives and how we might modify them. So it actually, although here I've tried to give the basis in terms of what we think we understand about aspects of how the ecosystem is operating, when we actually, of course, come to devising these management strategies, the real action will be in terms of those activities. And the idea of this, I also mentioned in terms of the integrated ecosystem assessments, that the regulatory framework and the implementation strategies are an integral part of that integral part of the overall process. So, and this, of course, really the purview of the council to help us understand what you'd like to try to achieve, and then we could run different tests or model runs to try to understand what the implications are as we understand them from an ecosystem perspective. So that's the way I would see it operating from that point of view. But one of the reasons I wanted to highlight Chad's work in terms of the coast-wide meetings to get input on how people felt about some of these things is that we'll need to revisit that and perhaps get more information from different groups in terms of what they would like to see achieved in terms of management strategies to set objectives. And then we could begin to work from that in terms of seeing what are our options in terms of management. A point that's somewhat related to Dave Gaethel's last point that I'd like to say is I do want to point out that, of course, there are natural changes in these systems, and how much we can actually tweak. I don't want to oversell what we can do in terms of actually tweaking ecosystem structure, but it's pretty clear that we can try, by our actions, we've sometimes put things out of balance, and we hopefully can put them back in balance by other actions. But it is very complex, and I don't want to oversell the fact that our ability to make easy and rapid changes from one state to another, because it's also set in a changing environment overall.
Time for a few more. Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really did find the presentation very interesting. One thing I noted was that you used landings information to, you know, show changes over time.
Yeah.
And I was surprised that you weren't showing biomass estimates instead of landings information.
Yeah.
And I was curious if you are utilizing both data sets or if you weight one more than another, and why maybe you chose to use landings in the presentation.
Yes, we. Thank you very much. We are using the abundance estimates, both from the survey and other independent estimates of biomass. Basically, one of the reasons I didn't show biomass this time or changes in abundance is that at the last presentation I made to the council, I showed some of that kind of data. So I'm trying to – I don't want to bore you with going over the same things, but, of course, I do know that there are new members and new participants at each of the council meetings. But it's definitely true, Mary Beth, that a critical part of this is the abundance estimates. And so when I showed that aggregate GARM result, for example, that was a biomass trajectory from our survey data where we superimposed on it a model result. So it actually does underlie virtually everything that we're doing. The reason I emphasized the catch this time was basically just to try to tell you that we're looking to get to an endpoint of what we'd like to say we feel is a sustainable level of removals from the system, and compare that with what we've seen in the past. So that was the reason for that choice.
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, John. I'm ruminating about Dave Capel's comments because I didn't come away with that understanding that you did. I mean, I think it was true that in the early work, the sum of the multi-species or single-species assessment significantly exceeded the integrated analysis. The new science has evaporated that differential. So it suggests to me that single species objectives to rebuild fish stocks to high abundance individually is not a flawed objective, because you're going to get to that place, the same number, through the multi-species assessments. It may be that the sequence that you pursue in terms of rebuilding is relevant, but the overall objective, achieving high abundance in all the components, I don't think is a flawed strategy, but I'd like to hear more about that.
Okay. Well, I think, Mark, the way to think about that, to turn that on its side, is basically you won't, when the mix of species we're dealing with are at reduced levels of abundance, they're not going to have strong interactions among them. It's actually when they're rebuilt at higher levels where the probability of strong interactions emerge. So my interpretation of what we're seeing is that we're at currently relatively low levels for many, not all of the groundfish species. And I think that one of the things that's coming into play is the fact that we're because of those lower levels of abundance, and they're not competing in the same way for resources as they would if they're all at higher levels of abundance. So I guess the story that I would tell is that when you're dealing with a system that has been badly degraded, that you're absolutely right. The thing to do is to take steps that would allow rebuilding appropriately. But what I would say is that the ecosystem considerations come into play when things are much more closer to an even keel. And then these interactions become more important. And so one way of thinking about that is that right now, if we've got a system that's dominated by human impacts on these resources, as we take the steps to rebuild them, other factors are going to become much more dominant in terms of what how things are changing, whether those are natural environmental changes or climate changes or interactions among the species.
We have time for maybe one or two more. Depends how long they go. Dr. Jim?
Yeah, Mike, along those same lines as a follow-up, really there's a distinction between rebuilding stocks to BMSY versus making them so abundant that they're at their carrying capacity. And mm-hmm. we're not talking about rebuilding stocks to their carrying capacity, but to the yeah. level where they'd be most productive, which
right.
is a good goal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply that it's not. But, of course, you know, the our estimates of the pelagic fishes right now, herring and mackerel, are above what we're saying would be the estimate of their MSY levels. That's one of the things that comes into play in overall and trying to understand the role that they're playing in the system.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Mike, thanks a lot. As you continue to go forward with this research, you and your ecosystem assessment program team, it would be very helpful to me personally if you would highlight the reasons why you and your team feel that it's important for us to continue to consider trophic level differences as part of our assessment of, let's say, the health of a particular ecosystem. Mm-hmm. You know, you noted that the TL, the trophic level changes over the last, you know, 30 years or so, 40 years, has gone from about 2.75 to 3.25. That's about 0.50 difference. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not convinced that very small differences in trophic levels are meaningful. Mm-hmm. That they can mm-hmm. be interpreted, that they can actually have an impact on our management decisions. Yeah. They're so small. So, again, anything you can do as you move this forward to help mm-hmm. us understand why we should pay attention to these very small differences would be yeah. helpful.
Yeah.
In addition, comments about seals. I was going to make a comment about that as well. Nothing in here about seals, but you did point out the right whale mm-hmm. Relationship to adult calanus. I'm surprised at how tight that relationship is, but then again, maybe I'm not so surprised. When I was a graduate student many years ago, we did a lot of research and reading about work done in Europe, mm-hmm. and it was all about Calanus copepods, mm-hmm. and that sunk in. And here we are a few years later, and it's all about Calanus copepods, and not yep. just for fish, but potentially for right whales as well. Yep. So yep. interesting research, and again, I look forward to continued revelations from, yeah. from the team.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Let me make a comment about the trophic level part. You're right to say that it might seem like a small change, but in fact, the models that we're using are very sensitive both to the average trophic level that you assign. In fact, if you recall that, I can show you a bit about that, David, if I can go back. I can give you an indication of just how sensitive the results are to the trophic level. If I get there. It's the next one. Okay, so what you can see, Dave, is so you're going about 0.25 trophic level units along that this x-axis here. But you're going down in that range from over a million, if at an exploitation rate of about 0.15 from a million to half a million along that trajectory. So although it might seem, those small changes might seem to be relatively unimportant, you know, when you think about them in the absolute terms, the way it actually plays out in the transfer of energy, they're quite important. And the reason, you know, the mathematical reason is that the trophic level is sitting up in an exponent in the model. And so it really alters quite a alters things quite a bit for that reason. There's a point that I was thinking of in the context of a couple of the questions that I should have emphasized is that one of the things I showed you, these are really pretty simple models, but we're hoping that they're simple and robust. That is, they're picking up on some very fundamental ecological principles that allow things to be more predictable, for example, than we can predict individual species, which are fluctuating all over the place. But the whole is much more stable than the individual species. And what we'd like to try to do as we move forward in this is, and I should say that we are working in our group with some much more complicated models, some of which deal with hundreds or thousands of parameters. But the idea of coming forward and having an idea that's both reliably estimated or models that are reliably estimated and make intuitive sense to everyone involved. One of the goals that we have in terms of, you know, coming to the council and working with, so that, you know, that picture that shows a really strong relationship between primary production and fish catches is an example of, I think, of how things are, you know, there are simple relationships that if we can take advantage of that are really reflecting ecosystem properties rather than individual species properties that comprise those ecosystems, that we can actually provide you better advice that, as I would say, is more robust and also more stable over time. So we're trying to seek out those kinds of relationships and bring them forward to the council.
Okay, I guess one more, either Tom or Chris. Then we're going to break for lunch.
If Mike could flash up, if you could flash up your second to the last slide. I guess, you know, I'm always concerned when a group that is titled the Ecosystem Assessment Branch is coming up ways to come up with strategies with allocation base that are based on either yield or revenues without any inputs from the management bodies and without any participants who are really regular participants in the management approach. So I guess it's a real question that I think the councils and other management bodies need to think about how far along you let a group like this go down this road before you start giving input on what your management goals are. And this is not going to be an easy thing to address, and I think, you know, the sooner we get to it. I mean, just as an example, the Mid-Atlantic and the New England Council may have very different ideas about what their management approach is for dogfish or monkfish or what those trade-offs should be compared to the scallop fishery. And, you know, I would hate to see these guys spend a whole lot of work doing this type of work without getting input from the actual management bodies on how they want to do it, and without the management bodies thinking about how they're going to reconcile differences of opinions between different groups. You know, do we need another 100,000 harbor porpoise, or do we need to catch more fish? You know, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know how we're going to resolve that.
Thanks, Tom. If I didn't make it sufficiently clear in my statement earlier, it is absolutely the case that it, and I believe the transcript will show this, that I said that it is the purview of the council to say what you want to achieve, and we're not trying to develop estimates at this stage that actually we make unilateral decisions on in terms of this kind of choices that the council would make, and it's the right of the council to make. What we are doing, though, is trying to look at what are the tools that we have available to us in terms of models that would allow us, once the council specifies what they'd like to try to achieve, how we could help meet those objectives. So what I'd like to say is that we're working more in terms of how you approach the general problem than how you deal with the particulars in this instance, which Tom is absolutely correct to say is really the role of the council. So, and if it were the case that the councils decided to have different objectives that may not relate to yield or revenues explicitly in the way I'm suggesting here, then of course we'll work to devise the analyses that would meet those. And David mentioned an example of an objective that would be different in a sense from the ones I'm pointing out here. But so if I did give the impression that we're moving forward in unilaterally making decisions about what the council would want to do and then see how it would play out, we're not doing that, and we won't do it. It really is, but we will seek the guidance of the council, what you want to achieve, and then we can figure out what the best way to try to support that initiative would be.
Well, I didn't have the impression that you were suggesting you were going to launch off and go do that on your own. I thought that's why you're here today, is to tell us that you're ready to start having that discussion. So
yeah, I guess what I mostly wanted to bring forward in this is that, and part of the reason this is framed in the way it is, this set of next steps, is that I want you to recognize that we know we need to go beyond the idea of trying to estimate the system-wide production potential to bring this to something that's useful to you, because you're always going to have to worry about cod and haddock and yellowtail and dogfish and the whole host of other species. So we know we will not have done our job just to stop at total system production and then say, well, the rest is up to you, but rather to say that I wanted the council to know that we're thinking about, once we have that guidance, that we've been thinking about how would we go forward to make it, part of the analysis that we would provide in support of your objectives.
Okay, well, thanks, Mike. We're half an hour behind, but I really do appreciate you taking the time to stop in and give us an update on where you are. We're going to...
Thanks very much, Sean.
We're going to break for lunch, unless it's something you need to say, Dave. All right.
The kind of interface that they were just discussing here, it strikes me that that's the function of the ecosystem management plan, is that exactly that kind of interface. And as soon as we put the habitat amendment to bed, that's what we're going to be immediately working on. And that's the point at which I expect that we'll be working very closely with Mike and in developing that kind of interface.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Fogarty. We're going to take lunch, 1 hour. We'll come back and continue on.
Michael, could you download...